You're listening to The Deceptionists, Truth Through Fiction. On this episode, Caroline, Kelly, and Dave reflect on The Deceptionists of 2011 and look forward to 2012 and our New Year's writing resolutions.
Nick and Socorro broke up, and Candace wouldn't shut up, and Finn, he recorded the whole thing. Ray, he said, damn you, and someone broke my camera, and it was New Year's, and we all started to sing.
Welcome to The Deceptionists, Truth Through Fiction. I'm Dave Acampo, and with me is some of my regular roundtable of co-hosts. We have Caroline Pruitt.
Hello.
And Kelly Stevenson.
Hello.
And, you know, we are a podcast dedicated to the craft of fiction. We trade stories. We discuss different writing advice that we've received. We talk about our pieces. And we generally attempt to bring a sense of community to the solitary act of the writer. And now it's 2012, and we've got, a little over a year of Deceptionist podcasts under our belt. So we thought for this installment that we would reflect back on kind of what we've learned over the year, over 2011, and then we turn it around and look forward to 2012 and talk about some of our writing resolutions for this year. And maybe in doing that, we'll talk about some of the shows that you guys can look forward to coming up. So let's talk about The Deceptionists. Kelly, this was, you kicked this off, so I kind of want to go to you first and say, what do you think after, I think we've got something like 17 episodes under our belt right now. How do you feel about The Deceptionists? Anything that you've learned over the years?
Well, let's see. I've learned that you have to make time to do anything, whether it's writing or recording a podcast, most definitely. But as far as writing goes, I think the thing that I really learned the most this past year was something that I guess I hadn't really sort of analyzed why I write as much as some of my cohorts. For me, it was always just because there were stories that I wasn't reading that I wanted to read, so I was going to write them. But a theme that I think both Dave, you and Paul went back to a lot was the idea that you write to uncover something, you write to explore human nature, you write to figure things out. And at the beginning of the year, that was like, well, I guess, whatever. I mean, if you don't know all the answers, I guess you could write stuff to figure it out. which isn't to be dismissive of it, but it was sort of foreign to me. And then kind of as the year went on and we did all the genre shows, and we sort of kind of shown that, like, no matter what your genre is, there's still that kind of theme of getting those personal relationships together and kind of, again, working out just the big questions in life, no matter if you're writing a Western or horror or science fiction. And kind of just as the year went on, that theme stuck with me. And by the end of the year, I think that's what I'm left with most after the first year, is that whole idea of writing to find things out. And I think I've definitely reached kind of a questing stage in my life again. And I kind of want to write to figure some shit out. It's kind of cheating and putting my resolution in there too, but that's definitely what I got the most out of this year.
Well, we can certainly let that one go, getting that resolution out there soon. I think that's really interesting. That definitely is a theme that I think came up for us again and again as we talked about, especially in the genre shows, and we sort of all, you know, looking at all the different genres, I think it kind of forced us all to sort of boil it down and be like, what are we really doing here? And kind of getting past the various guidelines and the tropes of each genre and seeing that, you know, at the heart of it was all, I kind of think of it still as what's in our tagline, which is truth through fiction, you know, finding that truth, whether you know it or you don't, but sort of, you know, that act of discovery is part of it. Although I totally realized that, you know, Kelly, you're, idea going in was like, there's stories out there that, you know, aren't written, so I'm just going to write them. And I think that's completely a valuable thing. And I think that that's a lot of, I realized, I saw a lot of myself in that too. I'm like, oh, I do that, don't I? Because I'm like, you know, this movie would just be better if they did this. And it sort of spins you into something and you end up writing something writing, getting excited about something because it doesn't, you know, there's nothing out there that's exactly that. And only you know, you're writing the perfect story for yourself, if that makes sense.
Exactly.
Like filling that void.
That's kind of exactly where my writing comes from, especially since I'm not, I don't share my writing as much as the rest of us. It's like, that's, my audience is me. And, you know, it's kind of like, it's like a tuning fork to me. If you, you can hit just the right note and it's perfect. And if it's just a little off key, it sounds terrible. And I see something or I read something that's just a little sort of off key, so to speak. And then I need to write it in key or in
pitch.
That's
really interesting. I don't have anything to add to that. But they, excuse me. I think it was one of the writers I went to see this year. I think it was Kelly Link I saw earlier the year, who talked about, was really advocating for reading really broadly, not necessarily, like, don't just read all the stuff that you think is good, but exactly kind of the things you were saying, like look for things that are interesting to you that you, that aren't quite done the way you would do them. And, you know, sort of take that approach. So I think that that's, and that's something that I kind of got from the genre show, you know, that just sort of really getting into the nuts and bolts of these different types of writing and sort of seeing the things that are in common and seeing the perspectives that people who write on them bring that I might never have thought of.
Yeah, that's really, I like what you said about what Kelly Link said about the, because I think I've often thought I wouldn't make a good critic because I tend to like even bad movies, and I think I realize that that's maybe because I like bad movies or bad books sometimes. I shouldn't say bad. I like flawed films or flawed books, because oftentimes I'll mentally be running with this idea that they kicked off, but maybe they didn't execute it perfectly. But there's this little gem there that you kind of want to polish and bring out of it. And so, I mean, that goes right back to Kelly's statement, I think. So, Caroline, how about you? Did you have something, I mean, we talked about the genre shows a little bit. Was there like an aha moment that you had in any one of these? Or is there something just over the year that kind of kept coming back to you?
I think my growth over this year, because I ended last year with having done about half of a NaNoWriMo, and then having started the podcast, so kind of being at a point of just having an idea of wanting to write but not having a specific project for it. And then early in the year, I took an actual writing workshop class that had a very like specific type of assignments to do. And I sort of I had done things like that in the past, and this time when I tried to do it, I was just kind of bouncing off it. It wasn't working for me as well. So I had sort of the revelation that I just needed to sort of dig into something that was really calling to me and just spend some time on it. And really over the course of 2011, particularly in the second half of the year, I got to a point where I was actually, you know, sitting down and writing something every day, just about, which I have never, like, I've always been the person who is like, I don't really need to do that. I'll just, like, you know, sort of hole up over a long weekend and churn out a bunch of words, and then I won't do it for a while. And so I really found, and it's one of those things that's really obvious when, and I'm always a little bit dubious when, you know, you hear the people say you have to write every day or you just will never do anything. But actually sort of becoming one of the people who realizes that there's kind of a, like, to think of writing as something you do, and really sort of taking those opportunities to sit down and get something every day and not worry about when is this going to be finished and all together, or just accept that it's kind of accumulating as I'm working on it. So that's kind of the point that I'm at right now.
So are you accumulating material on one project now at this point, one novel or one longer story?
No, well, I'm working, I've done a couple longer stories over the year, and I'm working on one now that I kind of see the end point for, but it's kind of like, I sort of realize that what I'm doing at this point is mostly for me. So it's,
there's nothing wrong with that.
No, not at all. Actually, that's what Kelly, this is the novel that I'm going to have a manuscript of and try to put out into the world, but it's just sort of the process of doing it has been several longer things that kind of built on each other.
Mm.
So that leads somewhere, but I want to wait till we're in resolutions to talk about
that. I was wondering if it was anything that you shared with us over the year, like if so that we give the audience, people that are coming back to listening, a reference point. Did anything that you triggered that you wrote this year that you shared with us make it into this?
No, that's a really good, because that was actually the stuff when I shared a couple pieces this year for Show Your Work, and those were both more out of what I had been doing last year. So the answer is no, I haven't finished anything that I started and shared on this podcast.
Okay.
And again, but you know, they're still there, so maybe it's something I'll go back to.
Yeah.
But that was more what I had been working on from last year, which you know, felt like it didn't have as much shape to it. Well, and I was just kind of trying little scenes and things out. Whereas once I got past that material from last year, I've really started doing things that have plots and that have characters with like arcs that are having, you know, beginning, middle, and end. So that's kind of a cool thing that I hadn't done that much for a while.
I see. I think for me, when I think back on the year of podcasts, I think I had a lot of opinions early on because I had, you know, been writing and talking to other people about writing for a while. And so when we started talking about where ideas come from and setting and plot and voice and character. And I think I had opinions on those, but listening to everybody, it really you guys all kind of helped add to that for me. I was like, that's a good way of thinking about it, and kind of solidified it. I think for me, when we hit the genre shows, and I'd be curious to find out from any listeners, you know, if you guys got a lot out of the genre shows. For me there, I think I had some ideas, but with our guests and with just the different topics of looking at each of them and looking at all of them together, as Kelly, as you kind of mentioned, and finding the commonality between those, I think those were the episodes that really kind of made me come away looking at the stuff I was writing differently. I think, and funny enough, as you guys might guess, the one for me that was the big aha was the romance episode, which I pushed myself to be on because I thought it was sort of outside of my comfort zone. And I'm really glad that I did, because I think as we were talking to our guest, Sarah, and we're talking about stuff, I think if you go back and listen to it, you'll hear me kind of go like, oh, and realize suddenly that what romance stories do really well, at least the modern ones that we were talking about, were focusing on both sides of the story, on the guy and the girl and how they meet. And that is something that should be applied to any piece of fiction about relationships, is what I realized. And so I was thinking about a novel that I had written for the NaNoWriMo, like from 2009, that I was in the process of revising, and I had brought a female character in, and she wasn't exactly a love interest, but there was sort of a tenderness there, but I was kind of using her as a plot device, and it was very much along those noir lines that, Caroline, I know we've talked about before, about, you know, like the femme fatale and like the female character that's kind of only in there to either be an object or to be like the, you know, to be a plot device that gives the double cross or this or that. And it really kind of made me look at my own piece of fiction and go, am I really thinking about what is going through her? Even though the scene is all from the point of view of the main character, and it's first person in his point of view, so it's all from his point of view. But I, as the writer, have I given enough thought to this woman and what her role is and what she's thought up till now, or am I only thinking about her in terms of where she takes the story because of her presence there, like a plot point?
Oh, cool.
And so that really made me rethink this one part of the novel that I wasn't thinking about before. And I think that was probably the biggest moment that I felt transcended genre. You know, I think in some cases I got some good ideas. In the crime fiction show, for instance, I loved Jay Stringer coming on here and talking about, you know, the haves and the have-nots, and crime fiction as social fiction. It gave me a different lens to think about stuff in that genre. But it was actually the romance one that got me thinking about relationships, because those relationships aren't a genre, right? I mean, that's in every book. It doesn't matter. It could be father and son. It could be, you know, but it made me think about what I was writing and if I was really thinking about both sides to any character that were any characters that were interacting together. So for me, that was the big moment.
Yeah, and Dave, just so we don't beat up on you in the the romance department. I actually, when you're saying that, I realized, like, one of the pieces that I've been writing recently, it's from a female point of view, and there's several like characters who that I kind of put in the story to like be her, like, basically ex-boyfriends. and sort of kind of framed the way that she approached, you know, things that happened to her later. And the more that, and I don't know if I was consciously thinking about what we talked in that romance section, but the more that I worked on it, the more I started to be like, okay, well, you know, how does she really look to these guys, right? Like, like if I'm just writing them to be like the jerks that she used to date, so that what's happening to her now is more interesting, then that's, you know, that's kind of, I mean, it's the same. It's a different kind of using a character as a plot device, but it's still the same kind of thing. So I ended up writing a lot more about those characters, because I'm like, okay, now I can sort of satisfyingly say that these are, you know, that these are sort of these two-sided relationships that developed, and not just, when, you know, sometimes it's okay to have a character who's just there to do something in the plot.
Oh yeah, but, yeah, absolutely.
But if it's like everybody, it's like just your main character is around, going around, you know, making all these decisions, and then everybody else is just kind of conveniently doing what needs to be done for his or her development, then you don't have as complete a story, I don't think.
Yeah, and it never hurts, I think, as a writer, in when you're in the mess of it, when you're creating it, to at least sidestep and think about, you know, would it help me in any way to think about what this character, who really just serves to bounce something off of the main character, you know, but what happens if I think about that character's trajectory? It may be nothing that ever ends up on the written page, but does it inform my knowledge of that? I mean, I think, you know, as I've said on this show before, I'm in the midst of scripting a comic book miniseries, and there was a point where we hit this sort of crisis point, and we had to sort of make some decisions about the mystery and the way things went. And so in doing that, I ended up casting around to all the different characters and trying to think about them. And there was even a point I remember saying to my co-writer, like, I remember saying, you know, well, okay, but I don't want her, just this character, just to be a plot device. You know, like, I want to think about what she would think in that situation and how she got herself into that position. And he's like, well, she really is just a plot device if you think about it. I'm like, okay, but let me make it work from her side, just so I know, right. Just so I'm comfortable.
So you feel better.
That I feel, you know, more like this is a believable thing. This is testing your characters against the plot to make sure that they work.
Very true.
You know,
do you find that when that happens, when you do sort of, you have a tertiary character and you flesh them out, do you find that they demand their own story?
You know what? In this case, it didn't happen, but I totally see that. You know, I did start thinking about that in the other thing, the novel. I started thinking about this character. She didn't necessarily demand her own story, but I felt like I needed to really solidify what that character was about. Now, as I write more about that, I can't say that she won't sort of invade my brain and take over and demand her own story. But, you know, that's definitely possible. It didn't take over anything yet.
I had that problem with my NaNoWriMo novel. I had a character that was really supposed to only be in like two scenes, and I needed her to have a history with the main character, just so that I could kind of half skip a lot of explanation and then also make him more interesting. And the minute I gave her a backstory, it was like she just kind of turned around and looked at me and was like, I am more interesting than anyone else in this book. Like, go write my novel instead. And it was like, well, I will later. Just let me get through this one first. And so we argued for quite a while.
Interesting.
Which makes me sound crazy, but
sorry, go ahead, Caroline.
Oh, I don't know what Dave wanted to ask, but I wanted to get a little bit of an update on, since we did the Cluster Fumble show about where we're talking to Kelly, and that's kind of the last time we've all talked together. Wanted to know if you had any reflections on that after that point.
No, it's still a cluster fumble. About probably two-thirds of the way through the month, I took a really long, hard look at it and was like, this is not fruitful. Just the constraints of NaNoWriMo for that specific project weren't working. And I had gone from like shoveling out words that I felt where I was making progress, you know, maybe a slow, clunky progress, but I was at least going good directions, to it was pretty much just like I was finding all the garbage I could and putting it on paper. And it kept changing into something else. It turned into like a hospital story. Like, I suddenly became obsessed with how the healthcare industry worked in this thing. And so I had like, you know, just pages and pages and pages of like something that wasn't necessary, because it was like, no, they just need to get in and get out and move on. And it was like, oh, but we could talk about this and we could talk about that. And it was like, you need to let go of NaNoWriMo and go. And I think that's part of what we talked about, you know, writing to figure things out. It was like, very clearly, there's something about healthcare and hospitals that I need to write. Like, I need to take some time in that. And given, you know, the amount of people in my life who've been sick and in hospitals, it's not surprising that might be something that bits of me don't want to ever think about again, and bits of me really, really want to think about. So I learned some stuff, but I did not finish. And what I had was not even, it was, you know, probably bits of four or five different stories that were not held together well.
I guess that's one of the big tricks, because you talk about, you know, that character vying for control of the story and saying, I want to go this way. And part of me wants to say, you've got to give in to that muse and just be like, you know, go where the writing takes you. But then I think, well, then do you end up with just reams and reams of unconnected material that doesn't assemble into anything? And if your goal is to put together a novel, let's say, then is this just an exercise in editing? Like, can you write all that and then just cut it and leave it out somewhere? Or is it, are these all individual pieces? I guess that's the tricky part, is when does it become a cohesive whole? Or are you just, could you endlessly write different scenes in search of a novel that never forms?
Definitely. I could definitely do that.
That definitely can be done, whether you want to do it or not.
I think, right. I think it gets back to that, like, I create worlds and then write stories in that world a lot of the time, just because genre fiction is where I love to be. And so it's all like, if you look at the story or the novel as the world, all of these things fit in there. Okay. Like, she needs an interesting backstory. Like, it fits in there. And so it kind of, it doesn't really belong in a book anyone would want to sit down and read front to back. But like, as far as what I'm creating, it's the world. So she fits, except not really.
But you've really got me interested in the idea of like a healer, or like a sort of healthcare story set in a fantasy world.
Right?
That might be like, and I'm thinking of something like Terry Pratchett has, you know, he writes the Discworld books, which is like this enormous universe, which there's a bunch of, and I've only read a few of them. But he has one series in there that's the Watch series, which is basically these really nicely constructed police procedurals that, so it's like, you know, very well done mystery stories that happen to take place in this like ridiculous fantasy universe. So that might be when you sort of think about different genres, if you're having problems, you know, if you have the world building and you need the structure for the story, that might be kind of a way to think about, or Shannon McGuire, who I've just started reading, her first book is called Rosemary and Rue. And it's basically a private eye story set in San Francisco, and the private eye is a fairy, like from a fairy kingdom. And right. She has this, and those books are like, those books are almost like, the first one I read, at least, it was almost a little bit too much just walking through the different parts of the world. But because she has that sort of mystery story idea, and that mystery story structure, she's able to take you to these places, to these different places, and sort of, so that seems like kind of a something that might be a way to approach
so,
that. Like,
so Kelly could either find a structure that allows her to dig into all these pockets, at least briefly, you know, a hospital scene, a something over here, you know, that does all that. Or the other thing I was thinking, and I can't think of a good example, but I know people have done this before, but would be like a collection of short stories that are all set in one fantasy world. So you're still building the world, but then you're allowed to go and do different little short pieces that are satisfying on their own, but maybe they slightly interconnect, or, you know, maybe they're just in the same world, you know, this king over here and this princess over here and this wizard over here, or whatever it is, you know. But maybe you have to find a way to encompass this sort of, I love to build worlds and then just populate them, but I don't necessarily know how to connect them all, you know.
That's how my big idea, capital B, capital I, world actually got started. I was writing a bunch of fan fiction for a bunch of different shows, and kind of wanted to mash them all together. And I was like, why? I don't I don't need to have crossovers. Like, I need to build a world where all of these sort of archetypes are, and I can put them together mm-hmm. however I want, and everything will be fine. And so I was like, okay, fine. So I'll just build it. And it started as, I called it Archetype High, because I'm so clever.
Nice.
And
that's great.
High school. High school.
Yes, because it was at the time when I was writing basically about high school students, because that's where all the melodrama is.
See, in my mind, I'm sorry to digress, but Archetype High is just the Breakfast Club. There's one student that encompasses each category of student.
Pretty much, yeah. Well, and when you write it, that's all you need. Like, you know,
yeah,
there's
right.
maybe, you know, 500 kids in the school, but there's only like 15 that you'll follow, if even. And so it's sort of, that became like, well, why are all these archetypes in the same place? And is there magic? And are there creature people? And are there magic people? And are there vampires? And are there aliens? And it sort of became its whole thing. And then I put it aside for a little while because, like, just that was satisfying enough. And then I came back to it like 2 years later and I was like, dude, why are you writing about high school? Like, you weren't even in college 10 years ago. And it's like, you can't, I don't know, there's things you just shouldn't do with high school kids. And now that I've started seeing them happen on these shows, I'm like, you're high school, quit it. I won't go down that tangent.
But you know what?
It will only get worse as your children get older, Kelly.
I know, and I know that's what it is. Like, it's so, I'm sitting there and I'm watching like Vampire Diaries and they're all drinking so nonchalantly and they're all having sex so nonchalantly. And the parents are like, yeah, of course our kids drink and have sex. I'm like, your kids are 16. You're not supposed to be cool with that. Like, the TV shows aren't supposed to. It was a huge deal when, like, Dawson and before then, like Doogie. I mean, come on. Anyway, so it kept shifting and it kept shifting some more, and then it became about the teachers who work there. And so there were some stories about the kids, but mostly it was about the teachers. And then it just kept exploding, and now it is this giant, giant world with, like, I have centuries of history because you have to figure out how everything gets everywhere, and it is insane how big this thing is. Only I haven't written I've written some, like, actual words of a story, but for the most part, everything I've written has been how everything works.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yep.
That's pretty fascinating, though, because I don't think I operate quite on that level, and that's sort of really fascinating to me, to work like that. But I kind of love it, because as you're sitting there talking about it, you're spinning my wheels, and I'm sitting here thinking of Archetype High, and now I'm like, it's like a Dungeons and Dragons group, but, like, they're all in, like, high school, and I'm thinking, that's awesome, I want that. So you need to write something like that. You know, I mean, like, you know, I think that's totally fun. I that's weird. It's so foreign to how I work, because I guess I think about the world in different ways, but I don't feel the need to build, like, centuries of history. But I feel like that's kind of the fun of it for you, is that sort of architecture.
I'll let you in on a little secret. I really like to know all the answers.
Interesting.
Yes.
But I mean, I wonder, could you get the whole platform out first and then actually write? Or would you be bored by that time and then not have any interest in writing the actual story that all this background is based on?
The way that I've got it positioned now, like, I have centuries of history, and then there's the story that it's leading up to, I guess the moment in time that it's leading up to is a pivotal moment in the history of the world. So after, like, a few series of events happen in this world, everything is supposed to be different. So there's still that question that has to be answered, if that makes any sense. So I don't know what happens next.
I see.
I've just sort of, like, put everyone – I've put, like, basically a giant series of dominoes up, and I don't know what it's going to look like once I hit go.
Yeah, yeah. But go is then your story. You've got to now construct the story, knock over the dominoes.
Right.
You know, or your other option is you could just write some kind of role-playing game and then sit back and let other people do the
the
stories
with
them. You could be the mastermind.
I was talking about this to Jim, I think a couple of years ago, actually, and it was just like, I don't know what I have. I don't know if it's a novel. I don't know if it's a comic series. I don't know if it's a TV show. I don't know if it's a video game.
I don't know
what I have. I just have this thing. And he's like, I don't know anyone who sits at something and looks at it and goes, maybe this is a video game. But, like, maybe it is. Like, I don't know. It's just this world.
Well, what it reminds me of is when I was a kid and I would play like Dungeons and Dragons, but I never really played that much because I didn't have any other people that were that interested in it.
Aww.
So I ended up, no, I mean, I did a little bit, but it was one of those things where I would sit there and I would read all the books and I would be fascinated by the world and I'd want to create my own dungeons and things like that. Mm-hmm. But then it was just building that world. And that's fascinating in its own right. I was really fascinated with all the fantasy tropes, you know, and all the things you could do with that. And that's so cool. And I'm like, yeah, what you're describing to me, Kelly, sounds like, yes, it is a video game and a comic book and a novel. And it's a universe that you could
set. It is a multi-bazillion dollar franchise.
It's a franchise.
My brain.
So Dave, though, just to contrast, when you started Wyrmwood, like how much of it did you know? How much of the mythology did you have in place when you started the story?
That is a really good question. Okay, so without spoiling the series too much, in case anybody, you know, listens to this and then goes and decides to download it on iTunes, we had a series Bible, and I had loose notes. I mean, I knew the main character had a tragic backstory, and I knew what that was. I knew that the town he was going to was kind of based on the town I grew up in, but that it had this dark secret about it. And I knew that there would end up being this secret object at the end of the first season that would be revealed. And that would turn out to be this kind of enormous thing that was an object of great power. And we kind of had notes in there about what the nature of it was. But that was about it. I mean, at a certain point, we just started writing the story, writing the main mystery of the first season. But then as other writers came into it, and so maybe Kelly needs a writer's room, too. She just needs to be a showrunner and then just... But the other writers would come in and they actually had to assemble the mystery. We all had to assemble the mystery. We gave ourselves this sort of structure, like, okay, we know at the end of the first season this is going to happen. Let's break down the first 8 episodes. And so we would go in there, and we knew a couple things. We knew it was a murder mystery, and we knew it was a horror show. So we knew that we had to be scary and creepy, but we knew we also had to have suspects, and then we had to have red herrings, you know, like somebody that seemed like they might be guilty, but then they would turn out not to be. And so we would just start crafting the story out of that. And you could go to the show Bible, but the characters in the show Bible had maybe a paragraph each. And by a paragraph, I mean like 2 or 3 sentences. And it might be something like, Hank Mason runs the inn, the Wyrmwood Inn, but he looks remarkably like a boxer from several years back named Johnny the Jackhammer Valentine, you know, and then maybe it would just be that, and then like we knew that there was something about he had a past as a boxer, and then he escaped, and now he escaped from the crime world of L.A. after throwing a fight or something like that, and then ended up in Wyrmwood, you know, so we'd have something like that, and that's all we knew. But what you do with
just,
the character,
I gotta say, I don't know why people pick my last name for characters like that, but they do it all the time.
Oh, Valentine?
I forgot that was your maiden name, right? That's your maiden name?
Yes. I never show up anywhere without it being a character
when
like
you,
that.
When you have kind of a pulpy character, the name Johnny Valentine just sounds very pulpy and cool to me, which is why I went with it. So that's an example of... of something that we did. But we had a roadmap, but there were stuff that we came up with. So another example, we had a guy that was like a homeless guy. He's like the town hobo. And we kind of had fun with him. He was very literate. He would always pop in and give all this advice. He was sort of like the kind of sitcom character you might see wandering in who's like chooses a lifestyle of being a hobo. But he's really like super intelligent and, you know, very wise and witty and all that kind of stuff. At a certain point in the last season, I came up with this story where I said, well, he's actually an immortal Viking prince. And that's why he knows so much. And that's why he's hanging around all this time. This is not in the beginning. This is not in the show Bible. Although the idea that there were Vikings that brought something over at one point was in the show Bible. It had not been connected to this character at all. So this is one of those things where along the way, you just come up with this idea. But then I not only had to do that, I had to execute on it. And I had to do this little historical fiction piece, you know, set in like, you know, Clontarf, Ireland in, you know, 1000 something AD and, you know, write this whole little piece. And that was, but, you know, it was just in the progress as we were getting to the end of the series. So.
But you wrote that character, like you didn't have to do any sort of retconning or anything. Like you managed to leave him with enough holes that when you filled it in, it didn't like
exactly
contradict anything
else. He could have finished the season. He could have finished the series being just a super literate homeless guy who chose a life of homelessness and like dumpster diving and stuff like that, because that was just who he was. You know, he could have been sort of a character like that. But at a certain point I just connected things and went like, okay, this is what if we do this? And everybody in the writer's room liked it. And then I just had a task of scripting that. But yes, you're right. There were enough holes. There wasn't like a filled in backstory about why he chose his lifestyle or who he was. The show Bible just had, like, again, one paragraph on him. You know,
so this is getting a little meta and probably a little Socrates-esque, but do you think he was always that character?
No. To be blunt, no. I think that we had certain characters that. So another example, there was a deputy, and I knew he was just sort of like the goofy deputy. But Jeremy wrote a line in one of the early episodes, and I had just thrown him out there as being a deputy. Jeremy had written this line where he's radioing the sheriff because they're out of coffee again. And it started this sort of running gag about, you know, he had this voice where he was obsessed with coffee. And then somewhere along the line, we realized that he got fired from being the deputy. And then we realized that he would have a nightlife as like an urban vigilante in this small town, like running around with nunchucks and stuff, just choosing. This was not written in any, it was not anything that we had in our mind at all. It's just that in this case, the actor's voice and the gag about coffee sort of just led us to slowly evolve this character. I think, this is a weird reference, but both Jeremy and I knew that for some reason in our mind, he was like, oh, what is his name? God, I can't think. I can picture him right now, but one of the sidekick characters in Beverly Hills Cop. They're the two cops following Eddie Murphy. I know I'm going really out on a limb here.
Judge Reinhold.
Yes, he in the second Beverly Hills Cop Part 2, we suddenly find out that he has this whole arsenal at home, and he's like this actually kind of badass, like gun crazy, you know, guy. Yet he seemed like such a meek cop up front, and we thought. And for some reason, both Jeremy and I landed on that as a reference point for this deputy. And so we just thought, you know, okay, that's who he is. That's his secret life. But again, it wasn't from the start. It just evolved over time. And I don't think that was in him from the start. And so, Kelly, going back to your question, the hobo guy, you know, I think we just thought of him as sort of a like a one-note character at first. Like he was flavor for the town. You know, like he'd be this hobo guy that would pop up and be very well read and have some. Originally, I think he was expositing a lot of stuff. Like, you know, the Native American tribe in this county used to call this blah 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 blah, like that. You know, he was that guy. Mm-hmm. And then it wasn't until I was looking to connect and wrap things up that I gave him this role and this whole guilt of why he was there in town still and everything. But that did not. I think that was something we just connected along the way.
So it seems like we're really talking about two contrasting approaches, and one would be to build your world just as thoroughly as you can, which is what Kelly's talking about. And I think with both of the writers, the professional writers I had mentioned, I think they must have had a huge amount of the world built. Mm-hmm. Before, you know, Tolkien wrote like, you know, reference books about Middle Earth before he ever wrote The Hobbit.
Maybe that's what Kelly's doing right now. She's writing those reference books. Seriously.
But then there's sort of the other approach of just, you know, knowing as much as you need to know to get and sort of leave those spaces. Because I think the thing is, Dave, if you had had your deputy character, you know, explain if you had learned everything about him in the first episode, then you wouldn't have had that opportunity later on to sort of take those other steps and build more things about him. So it seems like both of those, you know, and I'm sure there's ways to combine those approaches too, but it's really interesting that I think either of those can be really effective for world building, depending on how you're going to go about it.
I think if you had known from the very beginning that your hobo was a, you know, a mortal prince, you would have written him differently.
Yes.
And he probably wouldn't have felt as genuine as he did being smart hobo guy.
Right. And that's possible. And the other thing is that for me now, so you're talking about the approaches to writing, Caroline, is that I think for me, if I were to just write the backstory of everything up front, it would, I don't want to say it like this because I don't want to make it sound, Kelly, like I'm dismissing your side of it. But I think I would, as a writer, I would get bored with the actual story. Because I would have written all the meaty stuff. Like, I need to leave myself, and this goes back to the whole discovery thing, I need to leave myself some room for discovery. There was something really fun in writing a scene and suddenly going, aha, if he's an immortal prince and blah, 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 and making it all work, and then I was really excited to write that story. if I had known about that story for years and it just been, you know, sitting on it, I don't think it would have the same excitement, that sort of joy of creation for me in that moment. And that's not to dismiss the other way. It's just that, like, that's what it is for me to get me excited to write something like that. I had to leave enough mystery in it to discover as I go.
And I feel like we've had this conversation before, because to me, that's what I'm doing. Like, I know it doesn't sound like that at all. It's not so much that I have to figure everything out before I start. It's that nobody can move until I figure out where they've come from. And sometimes when I'm trying to figure out where they came from, that sort of, that blossoms all on its own.
Right.
You could toss in, you know, random guy walking down the street, but like, at some point, if he becomes important enough, you have to figure out, how did he get there? Or at least I do. I have to figure out how he got there and what was his life before then, so that I know how, when he talks to someone, what he's thinking. And when I do that part, then this whole backstory happens. Yeah. And especially when you're doing genre stuff, like, and this is, you know, me getting on my soapbox, but like, if you're going to have magic in the world, you have to know how that magic got there and like how it works. And there have to be rules, and you can't just decide stuff. So yeah, that's why I built worlds.
But now, so let me ask you, if you have the guy walking down the street and then, you know, you start to figure him out, but I mean, does that derail your story? I mean, you said like these characters will talk back to you and send you a different way. I mean, I guess what I'm getting, you said something else. You said before they can move. So do you find that stuff still happens once you've got them moving? And then once you have them moving and then you realize, hey, that guy on the street, I haven't figured him out yet. Does that stop everyone in place and then you've got to figure him out before you can move again?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
if he's important enough, yeah. I mean, it's kind of like, it's like oil in a machine, or it's like gears that sort of get wound up. If there's something that's not quite aligned right, everything just sort of grinds. And if I need him to move in a certain way, I mean, it's oversimplifying to say like the guy on the street, but like if somebody's having a conversation with someone and the conversation is important, I need to know why the other person's asking the question. Yeah. I need to know why they're going to frame the answer that way. And that, to me, that has to do with their backstory. And maybe, and I'm just thinking of this now, like maybe it's because I come from acting. You know, I took a lot of acting classes in college, and I have a degree in theater, and you do a lot about, like, even if you have a walk-on character, like, you have to know what their goals are and who they are and where they've come from and why they're walking on the stage at that point. And I feel, I mean, that's how I approach characters too. Like, I have to know what they're doing there and why.
And that goes right back to, this circles completely back to that relationships and romance stuff that I was talking about earlier.
Yes.
And that was my revelation was, yeah, okay. So I'm kind of coming around to understanding Kelly's side of it, you know? I'm tempted to say that Kelly and I should try to co-write something and see what happens, but I think she might stab me through the podcast.
You trade wreck.
That would be kind of great, actually.
Quit writing, Dave. We have to figure some stuff out. Right.
Actually, it would be a lot of fun to like take Kelly's notes and then just try to write a story in her world. That would actually be fun for all of us to do. Except for, I think she'd be like, "Wait a minute, you made up." I feel like that I would want to take some liberty, and you'd be like, "That world, that doesn't work that way. I've already scripted that part."
Almost, as sad as it says, I think I'd rather have you like look after my children for a few weeks and
pick something. Wow.
I'm sorry. Excuse me.
Wow.
You know, they're my babies.
But that's, you know, that's interesting because, you know, as you said, you come from the world of fan fiction. So the idea there is once the thing is out there and once it's written, then it's sort of fair game for people to sort of give their own takes on it. But as long as you're still incubating it, you get to protect it. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So wait. So
I think it's more like I wanted to find, and this is totally what Rowling did with the end of the book, with the end of the Harry Potter series. But like, there are things that you cannot mess with. And once I have those defined, it would be okay if someone else decided to play in my world. But there are certain things you don't mess with.
Right, right.
So, well, so I mean,
that's specifically why she wrote that epilogue, because she didn't want
totally.
To- She didn't want people to be like, any ending that I give this is just as valid. She's like, no, Ron and Hermione are together. You don't mess with that. So,
and I totally get the idea that there's a main story going on. But what I guess what I'm wondering is if, you know, someone else wrote a story set in the corner of one of those worlds where it feels the effects maybe of the main story that you're thinking of. But, you know, then, you know, it would be interesting to see what would happen in that. I don't know.
That would be spectacular. If I could make my life's work something like Harry Potter or like
Any of these universes, right? Yeah, like any, a Star Wars.
Yeah, it's just amazing universes that continue to inspire people 50 mm-hmm. years later to mm-hmm. write their own. I mean, like, who wouldn't want to do that for the rest of their lives?
I would be
okay with that. But then I can actually hear Jim, even though he's not on the podcast, saying, but first I'd have to, you know, share that with someone.
So are we sort of moving into the resolutions for next year, and maybe smaller size resolutions than create an enormous mythical one that people will want to share for 50 years, as you know, Dave is already doing with Wormwood, of course, but we aren't all of that. So are we ready to, Dave, did you have anything else you wanted to talk about what your progress, I guess, this past year? Because I know we've mentioned some of it, but want to mention, have we mentioned on the podcast your story that we did on the...
Yeah, I mean, I guess it is a good way of segueing into resolutions and stuff. So the comic book is coming along and everybody knows about that. And then the other thing is that, you know, I have a story that I wrote for this podcast that got published on Mulholland Books Popcorn Fiction site. The Smitty story that you guys may remember from early on. That was the How Smitty Smokes a Cigarette. And that was a lot of fun for me to write that, kind of using this podcast as a stepping stone. And it really was a great exercise in... writing without really knowing what I was going to write, you know, in contrast to all of this talk about world building, this was kind of the opposite of that. I was scripting it as I went along, and, you know, obviously it was set in pretty much the real world. So that story is now on MulholandBooks.com on their popcorn fiction site, and I'm really excited about that. That was fun for me because I think one of the things that I did this year with Deceptionist was kind of work in different genres and explore those. And so one of my resolutions is more short fiction. And I'd like to try, you know, more. I'd like to try it in a few different genres, and maybe short fiction that I can polish, and then try to submit around again. Because that was a lot of fun for me. So I don't know if you guys have anything similar like that.
My resolution is basically stolen from your resolution, because I was like, "Oh, Dave did a really neat thing with that." you kind of workshopped it through us, but I. Put together with the other genre shows that we've done, like I've sort of made a point of trying to read, like I've subscribed to a couple of short, like science fiction fantasy magazines, and to really kind of get an idea of, you know, so to sort of just think of things that are sort of in like the right sizes, because mm-hmm. I can think of, you know, things that are sort of like a little really too long to be short stories, but they're not really long enough to be novels. So really kind of sort of look, sort of think about, but some of the shorter pieces that I've read are definitely like they're things that could come from pieces of larger universes.
So basically, the
sci-fi one was the one that had most appealed to me, just because that's kind of the writing community I've been exposed to recently. But then I think that the crime short stories are interesting too. And I haven't ever written like something that's specifically a short story in a genre. Like I've written longer things that sort of have those elements.
Mm-hmm.
But so I really wanted to kind of semi-publicly commit to really try to get something semi-publicly. I guess it depends on how many of you are listening.
You heard it here first, folks.
to write something that I could try on some of these markets, and also kind of try out on you guys. So,
would you say that one of the things that you'd like to work on is kind of figuring out the size of a story? Like,
yes,
how do
really.
I write a short story? Because this could be a topic of an episode, I'm thinking of. Uh-huh. One of our 2012 episodes. Maybe we need to do something like this. Is how do you know when you... How do you pick a short story? Like, how do you sit down and say, okay, I'm going to write a short story, and then figure out how big that story is, you know, without like realizing suddenly that you have this super intricate plot that there's no way you can do in 3,000 words or, you know, whatever it is. I think that's really valuable because that's something that I think I struggle with that a little bit and kind of knowing that.
I have no idea how to do that.
That might be something that would be great to find a panelist who has done a lot of short stories and like drag them and get them to talk to us about it. That would be my suggestion.
Yeah. I think that'd be great. That's a good show. So, folks, if you want to hear about that show, let us know, and we'll give you the contact information at the end of the show. But you know, we're kind of, as you can tell here, as we're doing our resolutions, we're also going to be kind of teasing everyone with what we might talk about in the coming months, and I think that's a great one, actually.
Yeah, that's a complete mystery to me. I don't know how to write. And it's not like, all I do is write novels because I never finish anything either. But like, I have no idea how to tell a story in a small amount of time and make sure that everything's in there that needs to be in there.
Yeah.
That it's interesting.
Yeah, there's definitely a skill to getting in, getting out, and knowing that that's your story. It's usually a smaller scale thing. And sometimes that's harder to figure out, I think.
And it's definitely something I've done in workshop context in literary fiction, but it's in a way that you can kind of cheat. I don't want to say cheat, but like with literary fiction, the what needs to go in the story is a little bit more open. So you sort of have, not that I always did a great job with it anyway, but it's definitely more intriguing to me with genre and that. So. Would be interested in
I have some thoughts, but I'm going to save it because we might have a show about it.
Okay, no, I think that's a great idea for a show.
Oh, ain't no mind. I think we're having a show about this.
yeah.
Great, awesome.
Okay, so Kelly, how about you? Do you have a resolution?
My resolution is about finding time to do pretty much anything, but especially writing. I think it's interesting that Carolyn actually touched upon it earlier, that whole idea that, you know, you have to write every day. And everyone, I think, says that, except those of us who really want to pretend like you don't have to write every day.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But and it's, you know, it's like exercise. Everyone says, you know, well, in order to have a good habit, you have to do it every day. And then it'll become a habit. And for a while, I was writing every day. And then obviously NaNoWriMo, I was doing it almost every day. I need to get back in that habit, even if it's just 150, 200 words before I go to bed. It needs to happen.
Can we talk about Written Kitten right now?
talk about Written Kitten.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. Yes, go for it.
Yes. Oh, there's a website, and I'll have to link to this, but there's a website called writtenkitten.net. Like the word written, the word kitten, and then .net. And how this came up, and there are other websites sort of on the same theme, and I think there's like one called Write or Die, and there's some with other ones where you have to produce a certain amount of words within a certain amount of time, and so it'll save the stuff in your browser, and it will give you a word count right there, and then it's pretty easy to cut and paste into whatever word processing program you need. But one of my friends had made a comment where she said she thought those sites just added to her stress, and what she would really like is if you wrote a certain number of words and the website would show you a picture of a kitten. So somebody has written some code where if you go to this website and you write whatever you're writing, and when you get to 100 words, it shows you a picture of a kitten. They pull these from like Flickr or something, and then you cycle through with each 100 words, and you can have different settings on it, but you'll get a new kitten every time. So we found that's it's stupid, but that's honestly, like, since I've used that, I think I've gotten better word counts because I can really focus on that small space that I'm writing in, and you know, have a concrete goal, even if it's just that they show you a picture of a kitten.
You know,
but are they quality words, or are they, I really want to see what that next kitten picture looks like, words?
No, that's actually good because it's not enough of a motivation that I really care deeply.
Especially because, like, it turns out you can just go to Google and type in kitten images, and and you're done.
That's like the cheating version of it.
So you have to be geared into it. You're right. It's actually been
that's the equivalent
it's not enough of a distraction. Like, it's not like that. You know,
it's not enough of a distraction that it distracts me from the writing, but it's just enough that it kind of like measures the amount of time that I'm. So I think it definitely depends on your individual psychological makeup and how you use the internet.
It's funny.
And whether or not you like kittens.
My day job, without exaggeration, is going onto the internet and finding cute cat pictures. I'm not kidding.
Oh, I know.
So when I found 100 cute kitten pictures, then I go do something else.
Right.
So for me, it's Tumblr actually is where I go. I've got enough of followed enough people that I can basically, scroll through Tumblr for about 2 minutes and see a bunch of pretty pictures of things that I like to look at, whether it's, screenshots from movies or fashion or whatever. And then I can go about my day and go back to looking at kittens.
Mm.
But you could set that up as a motivation for yourself. You could be like, after I write 500 words, I'm going to go look at Tumblr for 2 minutes or something like that. I would not actually do that though. I would like be gone.
I do that. It would have to be like pull something from my Tumblr feed and don't let me actually have the ability to scroll.
Two ideas are coming to mind. One is we had a show, I think Paul, Jim and I did a show on writing spaces, like where we work.
Yeah.
So maybe we need a writing habits show, like how we work, and really examine that. But the other one is writing like a discipline show. And maybe it's a challenge, like we all have to write X number of words per night for a week, and then we'll do a show about it and see what our results were, something like that.
Or just adopt a different habit than you usually have and report back.
Oh, huh? yeah, exactly. Yeah, I wrote in a clown wig all week. No,
I wrote in a coffee shop.
I think the other resolution that I want to talk about for me is revision, and that's one that my co-writer Jeremy on like the comic and stuff like that, and we wrote scripts together. He's one of those constant revision people, like write a couple pages, then go back and rewrite those pages, and then go back and rewrite those pages. I tend to be a wait, and then get it all out in one draft, and then just correct it a little bit, and fix it up a little. And I'm not great at revision, and I think that it tends to work when I'm working with a co-writer, because then they can kind of make sure that. If I pass my draft through them, then I know that they're going to revise anything that didn't work, and it's okay. But now I have this whole novel that I wrote a couple years ago, and I really want to get back to it because I am putting out the comic book this year, and the novel I wrote is using that same character, and it touches on some of the same events, and so I really would like to finish it as we get the comic out. So one of my big pushes this year is to do revision and to really be able to go back to this longer work or even shorter works. I mean, the idea of revision, the idea of being able to look at your stuff with a critical eye, to not say, oh, this is all shit, but to say, in this part is shit and I need to fix it, but there's a good idea here, and then to be able to rework it, and also to know when the first time or the first version was good. I mean, the Smitty story, I did a revision after talking to some of you guys about it, and it was a slight revision, mind you, but I went back and I looked at it and I thought, no, I like the original better, and that's what I submitted and that's what got published. So, I mean, I did make that call work, but I at least had to test it out and try the revision and see if I could go a different direction, slightly different way with it, and see if it worked.
Yeah, there might be a brave thing if we could each, turn something in and talk about how we would revise it and sort of see that. But that might be a little bit demanding on us all.
Let's turn that over to the audience. Let's have the audience give us stuff, and then we'll revise their stuff.
We'll revise their stuff. That'll get us into trouble.
Yeah. That was a joke. Just for the record. We definitely need to get Jim on that show, because Jim doesn't edit.
But he edits as he works, right? He's a
so he claims, yes.
Right.
He just, when he's done with something, then he puts it away and he doesn't look at it ever again.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay,
right. But while he's working on it, he's struggling over each word, choosing it carefully, as I understand it.
At least I believe that's what he says. Yes.
Yeah.
That's why I think we need him on this. this conversation.
That's what I think is a little bit like my co-writer, you know, Jeremy. I think he reads, he maybe writes a couple pages and then just reworks it, makes sure it works, and then can move forward, you know. But I've seen him like rewrite complete stories and go like, well, it was about, you know, an ogre living in a cottage, but now it's a crime story set in New Jersey, and you know, like that, with clowns like that speak in iambic pentameter or something like that, you know. And it will be something that you can't even figure out where it came from, but you know, it's linked somehow, you know, the germ of it is still there. But you know, I mean, everybody works differently, but for me with this, I have this novel and I know there are good bits of it, but I know there's some stuff I have to work on, and so I really want to be able to do a good revision and not quit on it. But you know, it's not the most exciting part of writing for me is revising, and so I want to have that discipline to sit there and do that. So I propose that we do a show about revising your work and figure out, you know, what works and what doesn't, and some guys, I would love some tips. You know, we may need to find a panelist for that one. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
Any other resolutions that we have? To put this show out more regularly, perhaps?
Yes, definitely.
That'd be a good one.
We dragged a little bit. We said we were going to go to a month, and then immediately the next month was December, and we all got swamped with holiday activities. So this is our, you know, obviously our first show in January for 2012, and the goal is to continue our monthly show, and they'll come out about mid-month each month. So, folks, thank you for your patience, and we hope to get it out on a monthly basis from here on out.
Excellent.
Okay. So should we tell them where they can find us? Caroline.
Indeed. I never remember it. How about the website? The website is thedeceptionist.org, correct?
Right.
Yes. And we're actually also at thedeceptionist.com, not to throw a complete monkey wrench into everything, but that works too.
Oh, that works too. Oh, great.
Yeah. It does. And we need to talk about that later.
Okay. Yeah, but unfortunately, we made up the word, so you won't find it a lot of other places on the internet. Or I think technically Paul made up the word to give credit.
Yeah.
Credit, and then we're also on Twitter at deceptionists. And you can follow me personally on Twitter at Mad Marvel Girl.
And I'm at DACCAMPO, DACCAMPO.
I am at Anna Luna, ANNALUNA.
And then, folks, you can also email us at, what is it, deceptionist@gmail.com? Or what did we end up? No, it's contact@thedeceptionist.org. Yeah, that's it. Scratch that what I said a minute ago.
Does anybody check that email?
Yes, I do.
Kelly does, okay, yeah, because she'll forward us
theoretically.
Stuff.
Good for you, Kelly.
So contact@thedeceptionist.org. That's our email address. Let us know if there's shows that you would like us to cover in the coming months, or if you want to chime in on your own resolutions or reflections on how our shows were in 2011. Let us know, and also leave us a review on iTunes, because those are also very helpful for us. So you can find Deceptionist on iTunes and you leave us a review. That would be greatly appreciated. And join our, like us on Facebook. We are facebook.com/thedeceptionist. Is that right? Something
probably
like that. If not, just if you search deceptionists on Facebook, we come up. So you can find us that way.
Deception.
I think.
Yeah, I'm looking now. Yeah, it's the.
And as our guests look for the deceptionists on Facebook.
Right.
Okay, guys. Right. I think, are we wrapping it up? Is this good? Or is
yes,
this a
indeed.
Show? All right.
I think we're good.
So, awesome. Thank you, everybody, and we will talk to you all next month.